Let's try short intro.
Okay, go ahead.
OS 2 part 1.
Oh, this implies that there's going to be part 2. Okay.
Yes, there will be a part 2.
So basically what we are going to do is we are going to do 2 episodes that are going to be longer than the what OS actually made it on the market.
No. Your sarcasm is not valid here. So with that being said, let's roll the intro and let's start. Okay.
Now,
why did you say that OS 2 lived shortly?
Because it did.
No, it didn't. It lived much longer than that.
Yes, it lived much longer, but to make that point, let's talk about where OS 2 is today. Because it is still living today.
Yes.
It is living under two names. First is OS 2 and Arca Noah.
Okay.
Arca Noah being more or less reinterpretation of the OS 2 with complete compatibility to enable the specific applications that are still using OS 2 to be able to run on the hardware that is available today. Specific applications mainly being ATM machines and different things that were happily chugging along using OS 2 for the last, 35 years or so. And the same machines that are at the same time, some of them are also running NT4.
Okay.
So these are legacy machines that they could be replaced, but the cost of replacing them is huge. This is the first thing. And since the ecosystem or the entire networking and the system that supports them works, banks and different companies that are still using OS 2, they are not inclined to change the thing that works.
Yeah.
Especially if the downtime can mean millions and millions of euros of cost for no particular reason.
Actually, my reason for suggesting to do this episode, which was months ago, this is not a topic that we just invented out of thin air, was the fact that I noticed that a lot of people on YouTube were starting to kind of like reminisce about OS 2. I noticed quite a few videos on YouTube about it. And it kind of reminded me of the era in which we were heavily, you know, watching the fight between Microsoft and IBM in that market. It's not related to popularity. It's just that I was reminded of something that happened when we were younger. So that's the first reason. And the second reason, which happened a couple of months after our initial discussion, which was actually quite recently, is the fact that there was I noticed an article somewhere on the web. I don't remember where it was. I think it was on XDA Developers or something like that. That the Hobbs OS 2 archive is being shut down from the New Mexico, I think, University or something like that. And that's just further strengthened my initial impulse to do an episode, because I heavily respected OS 2.
Okay.
Even though I used it very little, but I was always enamored with some of the new things that it brought to the market, and there were quite a few. It was a first in many aspects, and a lot of these aspects were copied by other, let's say, OS vendors and manufacturers afterwards. And it is more a story about, generally speaking, which goes to your point about the product not living long in the market. It was yet again more of a story of IBM being perfectly incapable of doing things in a correct way than actually that being a bad product, which it wasn't.
It's the same thing as it would happen to the beta versus VHS back way then, and the different systems, different standards. Because in essence, the market is not always going to choose the best one.
Yes.
It is going to choose the one that for some reason or the other makes sense to them. So people are not going to go with the one that is necessarily the best. It may be the cheapest one. Mm-hmm. It may be the most available one, mm-hmm. the one with the most marketing, or in this particular case, the one that was most convenient. Mm-hmm. Because IBM did what IBM always did, and this is that IBM didn't market this operating system as much as Microsoft did. And in the same time, Microsoft was heavily pushing to get the operating system out of the IBM's hands. And it was trying
after
to,
initial cooperation, yeah.
Yes, because they realized that they need to do something else and they need to decouple the operating system from the PC.
Yes.
And they didn't want to be just another vendor that is going to provide operating systems for IBM.
Yeah, I think that this actually kind of like calls for an episode about the Clone Wars, which we might do sometime later in the future, because that was a thing in the 80s, especially. But I think to your point, basically what happened is, as we said, IBM being IBM, I would kind of say almost never figured out how to approach the personal market, you know, the end customer market in terms of home users of almost anything. And the OS2 is just another example of that.
I think that the problem that my IBM always had, and that this problem is visible today, is that they considered themselves an enterprise company.
Yeah.
And they...
Corporate. That's
since,
what it is.
Since they are dealing with enterprises, corporate entities, they don't have the infrastructure necessary to deal with end users. This is the one thing. And the other thing, as soon as they create something that is interesting for end users, it starts bleeding money. I'm thinking about ThinkPad Line and the laptops, and I'm thinking about printers and Lexmarks. Mm-hmm. When they got the printer division sold out or spin off as the Lexmark, and then it became a separate entity. The thing is that they are unable to create an ecosystem that makes sense for the end user.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they continuously make as a mistake is that they are, from my point of view, trying to create support that is completely overdone.
Okay.
So, for example, when they were doing the PCs, you were able to buy... parts for the IBM PCs back, I don't know, 15 years back. So they were supporting PCs that were 15 years old. First thing that happened when ThinkPad line and the home PC line from the IBM went into the other company was that they discontinued support for all extremely old PCs. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. It makes sense in a way that you want to support your corporate customers. But end users don't care about support 15 years after they bought the machine.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that IBM just didn't understand.
Yeah. I'm going to skip over all of the stories about the, you know, the meetings between the Gary Kildall and IBM and Bill Gates and IBM and licensing and royalties and whatnot. That's less interesting to us. And also, this is something that was heavily discussed in many YouTube videos, and you can easily find that on YouTube. You can watch Computer Chronicles. They have a couple of episodes about this. They are excellent episodes about that problem as well. But as you were saying, basically what Microsoft wanted to do is to decouple the OS from, let's say, some kind of a standard corporate overlord and a specific entity. And this is where Clone Wars came in handily as well, because the PC market went from it's an IBM thing to it's an IBM compatible thing.
And then suddenly it was an IBM PC, and then it became just a PC.
The PC, yeah.
And then it just became a desktop.
Yeah.
And we suddenly even lost the personal computer part, because everything was, more or less everything was a personal computer. And now nowadays, nobody's actually mentioning that they have a PC at home. Because what do you consider a PC? A laptop or a desktop, a Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, initially PC was more or less a thing that was that reminded us that it's x86. But it doesn't have to be that way.
But anymore. The personal computer was something that you could actually afford and run by yourself. Because the other option was to have a corporate PC or corporate computer,
mm-hmm,
that would be either time-shared or that was run by your company, because the computers were too expensive.
Yeah.
And this was... The 80s were... time when there was some sort of, I wouldn't say democracy, but some sort of Wider application of new ideas in the technology market. So the Z80s, 6502s, 8-bit clones, 16-bit clones, and so on, were creating their own markets. And then suddenly IBM entered the market with something that was more or less compatible with itself, that had huge numbers, had the backing of a huge entity, so the IBM, and IBM had to do something with the operating systems. And IBM being IBM just said, okay, we are going to get an outside vendor to do it. And then we are going to either spin it off or buy the vendor itself and then create this IBM operating systems out of it.
Yeah.
And they started this with DOS, because there was an IBM DOS.
IBM PC-DOS, yeah.
There was an IBM CPM.
Yeah.
There was came the MS-DOS. Then came the IBM OS2 that later became Windows, basically. The same thing happened with the SyQuest and the MySQL Server later, and the operating database servers, because this is also what Microsoft did.
They buy other corporate entities to embed them more.
Yes, this is something that's been happening for a while.
Yeah, actually, to set the stage to the topic that we are discussing, at the time that we are starting our story on the market, like let's say mid 80s or something like that, you had MS-DOS, you had some initial versions of Windows right around that time period. Windows 1 and Windows 2 came roughly around that time
1991,
period.
1991, yes.
Yeah, a little bit after that as well. And you had some DOS, that, and DOS, some versions of Windows, and OS 2. And the fight on the market, although it was very much hyped up between mostly Windows and OS 2 at that time.
You had, because the market was so small, you also had Minix.
Yeah.
You had Unix clones and Unix itself.
Yeah, we talked about that in a separate episode.
Yes, but this was more oriented towards people who actually run computers and run the programs in their corporate role and then wanted to do something similar at home.
Yeah.
But the market itself was split between a huge number of players, basically.
Yeah.
Because you need to include the DirDOS.
Yeah.
You need to include the, how is it called? DivX, DV, the first experiments on trying to do a multi-threading and multi-processing on MS-DOS.
Mm-hmm.
So,
The CPM had some concepts like that as well.
Yes. You had terminated state resident programs that were trying to also do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You had different operating systems that were experimenting, because I remember that there was a system called Plan 9 from Bell Labs.
Yeah.
That was specific because I remembered it because I tried it. And specificity of it was that it was actually completely object-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
So it was strictly designed to for everything to be an object. Everything could have its own classes and so on, so that you could actually create operating system that would be Unix-like in the way that Unix is, everything is a string. So in Plan 9, everything was an object.
Mm-hmm.
But OS 2 was probably the first one that actually looked nice.
Not only that, you touched on a very important topic, which is the object orientation of OS 2. That's a very good shout, because OS 2 was basically the first desktop OS that had that really implemented on the OS level. This is something that Microsoft noticed in OS 2 as well, and according to the stories, they kind of copy-pasted it into Windows in later versions. But OS 2 was the first one to have that as a widespread desktop.
Yes, but the thing is that what I'm always surprised is how badly Microsoft copied the first concepts in the operating systems.
Okay, fair.
Because what they did is they created some sort of I would call it a mixed or a salad out of everything that they saw, that they thought that is going to work on the market. So they introduced concepts left and right. It's hard to say they're stalled. They reused the concept of objects.
Reinterpreted.
But what the reinterpretation did was that they created objects that weren't objects. They created messages that weren't intended for the objects. And so they created some things that didn't make any sense when it came to the whole image. And sometimes, and this is the case even today. Sometimes you don't understand why the Microsoft is right now implementing something, because it seems that they are just trying to follow a trend.
Mm-hmm. And actually, while we're on the subject of object orientation, this is one of the reasons why I got negatively hooked up on OS 2 initially when I was younger, because of that. Because for me, object orientation was something. I mean, I was 9-10 years old when some of these OSs came out. I was way beyond young, so too young to understand some of the concepts. That's why I was a little bit more disparaging towards OS 2 when I was younger. When the real fight started heating up, when Warp entered the market and all of that blunder, which we will cover in part two of the topic that we are discussing today, that's when I started realizing that the things that IBM did in OS 2 were very reasonable and quite user-oriented to make things easier. Just as an example, the presentation manager, which they, I mean, that's the user interface that they introduced in 1988 or something like that. I was 11 years old then. I mean, you were a couple of years older than me, but still, we were, you know, not even teenagers back way then. You could have just, let's say, use a document file as an object on the GUI, drop it into the fax program and send fax in OS 2. This was something that was completely normal, even in the early versions of OS 2, like OS 2.1.1 or something like that. Windows got that way, way later in terms of that object-based approach, which definitely, now looking at it backwards, you know, across my shoulder, IBM was right to do that. And that is a way better approach than doing it without the object.
I think that the thing that we need to keep in mind is that IBM's approach to creating an operating system was more academic than what Microsoft
fringe
did.
Fringe engineering group academics meets, you know, technical superiority, want to do something good.
Yes, but the main idea was not to make a commercial project. Mm. The main idea was to create a complete project that made sense.
Yeah.
And then they realized that once a project is going to make sense, it is probably going to be something is going to be commercially viable.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Microsoft just wanted to create a nice pictures and create an operating system that's going to be nice. Not eye candy, but nice to look at and useful for the most of the end users. And what got thrown away was the deep compatibility between different parts of the operating system. Microsoft was just, as it does today.
At the start, it was like that, definitely.
Yes, but yes. It's the same today.
Not up to that level.
But when the operating system changes the search function every couple of months, when the operating system breaks down every couple of months in the way that it doesn't have Explorer running as it was with the update a few days ago.
Or forgets that it has cmd.exe.
Yes, so these are the things that point to the operating system being more of a patchwork than the actual structure of something that interconnects together.
Hence the reason why probably, or maybe one of the reasons why they brought people like David Cutler into Microsoft Fold to declutter a lot of stuff that were happening in Windows, but that was way later. I think that what they need to do, and quickly, just like Cisco in iOS, and they started years ago working on that, is to declutter the code from all of the stuff that's completely useless, and there's quite a bit of it.
Yes, but the other thing is that they are trying actively to declutter it now, but I think that where the current market stands, Microsoft hasn't yet decided to go which way to go. They obviously are at the crossroads.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they are unable to decide if they are going to just stop trying to sell people operating systems,
mm-hmm,
and give them something that's going to be a strictly operating systems as it should have been from the start, or are they still going to push for an operating system that's going to cost some amount of money? Because
mm-hmm,
right now, basically, what you do is you can get the operating system for
next to nothing,
and Microsoft is still trying to include different programs, different applications inside the operating systems.
Yeah,
this, from the point of view of the user, is nice to have, but it also doesn't make too much sense. And trying to what should have been done years ago or tens of years ago is they should have tried to move the applications to separate packages and then to allow the user to install whatever they need.
Yes.
And this is something that Microsoft is slowly doing,
mm-hmm.
but they are completely unsure which way to go. So they are keeping their
again,
their
instead of using the stuff that are already widely known and work, they are going to figure out their own way.
Yes, they are right now figuring out that you can do a sudo, so you can actually...
and that first-party application that manages Windows Store applications that you mentioned a couple of months ago.
Yes, the Winget.
Yeah.
The Winget is the package manager for Microsoft.
Yeah,
no, there is a Winget UI that is the separate UI that manages the Winget.
But from third party.
Yes.
This
because
Microsoft
decided that since they are going to create a package manager, they are not going to innovate. They are just going to make something that is going to be the same thing as other package managers in Linux. So it's going to be command line based. And okay, it makes sense in a kind of way.
Yeah, for us, but not for a general population user.
Yes, and this has continued to happen. Mm-hmm. Right now, I installed a couple of days ago a language model, large language model that is available for Windows 10 mm-hmm. and 11. That is, they are not calling it Microsoft supported, but it is encouraged by Microsoft.
Okay.
So there is a project that you can install, and this project is intended to create a large language model that you can run locally, and you can answer some of the questions. So it is lagging probably a year and a half behind other language models, but it is becoming part of Windows.
Okay.
And
hopefully search, so it's going to break down search.
No, I think that the way that things are being done now make much more sense than what Microsoft would probably have done. Because it is not deeply integrated in Windows. It is shallowly integrated. So it works. You can run it from the command line, but it doesn't use any of the internal APIs. It is not connected directly to the kernel and so on. What Microsoft is probably going to do is probably going to dig the kernel up and then put it inside the kernel. And this is going to be a big problem later.
Okay, back to OS 2.
Yes.
One of the things that when I was, I actually did read a little bit about OS 2 history before we started recording this episode, because I am familiar with the OS and the various things that various versions brought to the market, but not very deeply. And I found a like astounding list of innovations that were presented via various versions of OS 2 that came to the market. Literally the first one that was introduced in 1989 in version 1.2 of OS 2 is something that we nowadays and have for the past, I don't know, 10 years or so taken for granted. OS 2 version 1.2 in 1989 had dual boot support. Can you put that into historical perspective, how important that is now? I mean, let's just put it out there. Our classrooms in our college have multi-boot on every single computer, and we are far from the only ones using it. There are a lot of people running Linux and Windows on their computers at the same time. Both you and I did it many, many times over. I mean, we are talking 1989. This was 35 years ago.
Yes, we are talking about the first iteration of dual boot that came to market, because the second time dual boot was actually mentioned and something was done about it was Lilo back in 1993.
Yeah.
In 1992-1993, because Linux needed something like this.
Yes.
It was a necessity. It didn't want to do it, but it had to do it because you couldn't run virtual machines and you had to run it on the hardware that you had.
And most people wanted to have Windows.
Yes, and you didn't have that possibility of running multiple disks because the disks themselves and the hardware itself was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to mention something else. Since I was mentioning the databases, OS 2 was the first operating system that actually had integrated database. The version 1 had DB2.
This is astounding. I mean,
yes, and this is one of those things when you think about it and say, okay, but why did it stop?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the reason why IBM put it into the OS 2 was because IBM was IBM,
and when they wanted to sell their apps, probably.
No, not only this. It was called the OS 2 Extended Edition, and the idea was that you had a database inside it that was sort of kind of DB2. It wasn't compatible, but it was like DB2. And the idea of this was to have operating system that is going to have the database included because you are going to be needing the database. But the database itself didn't make any sense for the operating system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Nowadays, you have multiple databases including the operating systems, but you don't know about those.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know that you have a journaling system that is also a database. You don't know you have an indexing system that is also a database. You don't think about those things. But mm-hmm. there are databases inside the operating systems. But way back then in 1987, mm-hmm. including a database as part of the operating system was completely...
it's kind of bonkers, I mean.
Yes. Yes, first because it... From the operating system perspective, it didn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
It just made sense because IBM said, okay, we are going to provide the user or the programmer or the developer, whomever, we're going to provide him with the entire ecosystem that he needs. Because you always need a database.
I actually watched through more than a few YouTube videos over the course of the past couple of months. While we were brewing, let's say, our brains for this episode. And I watched an episode about programming for OS 2 and various other things. And it was not just one video, it was multiple. And a lot of people who were doing the programming back then were very commendable about IBM and their approach to OS 2 in terms of documentation and APIs and, you know, libraries and whatnot, how easy it was to program. Unlike in Microsoft, which started doing that way later in terms of documentation and availability of programming concepts and whatnot, it was way harder on Microsoft at the beginning. And I found that to be counterintuitive to what IBM is nowadays, in a sense, which makes sense because they were trying to make a new product in a market which Microsoft kind of like took by storm in many different ways. But at the same time, bundling applications with that without any real killer applications, OS 2 was always lacking those native applications out of the box when the OS came out. That's why it had to have a good support for running Windows and DOS applications, which it had. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, looking at that now with all of the mishmash of these things that I said, OS 2 was almost from the first version a very, very forward-thinking product.
But I think that the thing that we need to emphasize is that whatever you may think about the operating system not being able to support a lot of applications...
No, they just weren't developers.
Them, yeah, yes, but none of them were intended to do this.
Okay.
You were intended, this is, I think this is one of the things that IBM didn't do purposefully, but it was just the result of what they were. Because as a user, you were expected to have your own developers. Way back then in the 70s and 60s, when IBM was pushing the big iron to the market, you got your machine, the operating system was kind of sort of afterthought that enabled you to connect to the hardware, mm-hmm. and then your developers were supposed to be creating the applications you're going to be using. Yeah. So they...
Like a reminiscence of a past era.
Yes, this with this frame of mind, they decided they're going to do the same thing with the operating system. Because they said, okay, we're going to create an amazing operating system. We're going to enable you to do amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not going to give you the tools to do it because the tools are going to be created by the market itself. And this is one of those things where IBM and Microsoft did separate things. Microsoft realized that they need games.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that they needed some sort of applications and some sort of... they need to fill the market with applications also regardless of the operating system itself.
Okay.
So they created all the different things that got created during the 1991, 1992, 1993. And this was the time when, because we are talking about a small time span.
Mm-hmm.
We are right now basically probably an order of magnitude slower when it comes to introducing new technologies. Than we were 30 years ago.
Yeah. The law of diminishing returns does that as well.
From the 1991 to 1995, you got a couple of versions of DOS, you got OS 2, you got the Windows 95.
Linux.
And so Linux and different technologies that just came to market one after the other, and it was hard to keep up.
Yeah.
And Microsoft had different ventures in different technologies, internet channels for the Windows Explorer, or sorry, for Internet Explorer. They tried to create the Active Desktop, so they were trying to do something else with the desktop. Yeah. So they experimented. They are not doing that today.
Yeah.
We think that we are being experimented.
No, I think that experiments back then were much more polished products than the experiments today.
This is one thing, and I think that the experiments back to the back way then were much more bolder.
Agreed.
When you experimented, you actually told people, okay, now I'm going to do a completely separate thing, and this separate thing is going to be completely different with what you saw up until today. And I think that the only thing that could compare to how those things were run back way then is the way that AI is being run right now.
Okay, I agree. Actually, when you look at the list of innovations that came after that in some of the versions, like OS2.2, which came out in 1992, I mean, it was a 32-bit multi-threaded multitasking OS. That was a generation ahead of Microsoft, which was 16-bit at that particular point in time. It had page memory. It had loads of other capabilities. I mean, it had Windows support. You could install Windows apps. You could do MS-DOS applications in multiple windows. So real multi-threaded boot manager.
I'm just going to go back to the list of the things that OS2 did, and I'm going to also mention that they were the first one to introduce multitask text mode session, as it says on Wikipedia, but being called, they were calling it screen groups. Mm-hmm. What you could do, you could create multiple DOS prompts,
yes,
that were able to run concurrently.
Different applications.
Running different applications. And this was more or less everything that was needed back way then, because you didn't have any other applications. Most applications were DOS-based.
There were just one problem with that. So the technology was, most people say, I haven't had the chance to try this out. I haven't invested many hours in OS2. I was always more of a Microsoft-based dude in those years. But most people say that that worked pretty freaking well. But there was just one problem, and that's that a lot of these technologies that IBM introduced into OS2 were suffering from something else, which was the state of the market in terms of memory. Okay?
Yes.
Memory pricing, specifically in that era, it was constant. Then all of a sudden it jumped heavily like crazy, 10 times more, and then started slow slope of decline, while at the same time, newer OSs were always more and more demanding on the hardware. And some of the versions of OS2 that we discussed already needed something like 3 megabytes of memory to work. And that kind of...
Limited, extremely limited the amount of hardware that you could use.
And also the appeal to the users. Because the upfront investment into a box that is going to run OS2 with 3 megabytes of memory was way more than running it with, for example, MS-DOS.
And the other thing was that you had, what they did is they introduced 16-bit computers back way then, when 8-bit computing was actually the norm.
Yeah.
And then they were even trying to push the 32-bit computers when...
1992, the version 2.0 was already 32-bit.
Yes, but the 32-bit processors were not that...
386. We are talking about 386.
Yes, but they were. You had a lot of 286s on the market back way then.
Completely
and the
true.
EXPs and so on. So, XTs, sorry. And mm-hmm. the thing was that all of those systems were unable to push the new technology further. And you had to buy new computers.
Mm-hmm.
And also... Always, we need to remember, because we are talking when we are talking about how old we are. Computers were not a commodity back then.
Yeah.
Now I can just if
computers
I want,
were investment.
Yes, if you want to, but try out a new operating system right now,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have, let's presume that you don't know how to do it. You can always go and for the price of the operating system, go buy a used computer. And then try it on a new computer. So mm-hmm. you can separate your workspaces or your computer from your experimenting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why the so-called home lab is right now so interesting to people.
Yes.
Back way then, what is now considered a home lab would be considered a production environment for a big company.
Yeah, Agreed. That's what commodity brought to the market.
Yes, because right now, I was just yesterday, I was checking something on my, I have an Android system back home. My Android system has 64 gigabytes of RAM. It is i7, I think it was 8th generation or something. Mm-hmm. And it is running something like 12 or 13 applications at the same time. Running 13 servers or 12 servers was something that would be done in a corporate environment.
Yeah.
And the idea of running multiple databases to do different things 20 or 30 years ago was completely bonkers.
Yes.
You had your own database, one. You had your application. You had your application server. You had quick disks, but the disks themselves were two or three orders of magnitude slower than what is considered a fast disk today. So the entire infrastructure, the entire technology that was available back then was dictating what the operating system could actually do.
Yeah, you just reminded me of the fact that I spent half of the past week trying to get access to the USB floppy and floppy disks and whatnot. And whoever says that floppies are a useless technology, you don't know shit. Sorry to say that out loud. Anything. Anyway, going back to the story, around 1990, this is where the Microsoft-IBM divorce happened, because IBM wanted something, Microsoft wanted something else. They divorced. Microsoft took over development of their own OS. IBM went in the opposite direction with development of the OS2. And this is where they basically became direct competitors. Although, to be fair, they were competitors while they were developing OS2 as well, because Microsoft had DOS and which was given to IBM for a flat license fee, but they had Windows, which was direct competitor to OS2 at the same time.
And the thing it was that if you had DOS and you got a paid version of DOS, you got versions of Windows. You could actually get some versions of Windows together with the MS-DOS. This was one thing. And the other thing is that since IBM... I wouldn't say lost, but they weren't interested in winning the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
They lost the ability to bundle operating system together with the machine, because suddenly they had an operating system that was something that they didn't know how to sell, because they weren't used to selling just software. At the same time, you had any number of clones that were cheaper than IBM. They weren't cheap, but they weren't cheaper than IBM, because IBM was extremely expensive.
And the OS2, when they bundled it with the PC, was substantially more expensive
yes,
than
so
else.
You had to either buy an IBM computer that was expensive together with the OS2, which was even more expensive, or you could get your own whatever PC you got from the market and then put MS-DOS on it for the fraction of the price.
Yeah.
And this is one of those things where IBM just deployed.
And actually, you reminded me of one more thing. I read about this. I haven't had a chance to try that version too. IBM's OS2 for Windows. They had a product that was aimed at Windows users that basically overlapped Windows with OS2
yes.
in one single product. But what I find to be more hilarious about that is that the code name of that product was Ferengi. Now, okay. Me being Star Trek fan.
Yes.
And this is something that this is a premonition of what's going to happen with OS2 Warp at launch, but we're going to talk about that short in a different episode. Basically, they wanted to kind of like have both of the OSs running at the same machine and sell their license for their piece of software on top of Windows, which was a crazy idea already back then.
And this is the thing that actually is happening right now, and I think this is going to happen, because I sincerely think that in a couple of years, Windows will have Linux incorporated inside the kernel.
They already have that in a sense,
no,
yeah.
No, but I wouldn't be surprised even if the opposite thing happened. If the Linux kernel would be the primary kernel that would boot the OS, and then the Windows and the window manager and everything else that you're know as Windows just becomes something that is running on the Linux kernel. Mm-hmm. Because it is not it isn't something that should be too complicated to do, and creating this version of, I would call it a virtual machine, together with some sandboxing would be probably the best way to go in regards of security.
Do you want to basically like do a copy paste of what IBM called OS2, better DOS than DOS and better Windows than Windows, and then do that on Linux on Windows?
Probably yes.
That would be hilarious.
But I probably think that this is something that could happen, because this is what Mac did.
Yeah.
This is what Mac did. But what they did is they started from the scratch. Mm-hmm. This is what Google did. They also started from the scratch. They used the Linux kernel, and then they created the operating system on top of it.
Okay.
That with all the applications, UI, and so on. So why wouldn't Microsoft do it?
Especially when you have thousands of people developing the kernel.
Tens of thousands of people developing the kernel. This is one thing. And the other thing is that you suddenly gain the ability to run any application on the market.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do... multiple architectures, you can do multiple applications, you can both run applications that are designed for Linux, you can run applications designed for Windows, and so on.
But then Windows applications would need to be run on some sort of, let's say, Wine-like layer or something that's going to be an emulator.
Yes, but with the price of the memory and the capabilities of modern computers, this is not something that is...
No, I'm not worried about the speed or the RAM or the disk.
No, but this is not something that is a problem. It's just a technological hurdle now.
I mean, when you mentioned Apple did extensive work in terms of the Rosetta compatibility back then. Now, the latest version of Rosetta for x86 to ARM, let's say, translation, which is much more, let's say, involved on a much deeper, closer to hardware level than what we are discussing here.
Yes, but this is M1, and I must say that most of the time, I have absolutely no idea for which architecture is the particular application designed for, except when it comes to some of the applications, and I'm looking at you, Chrome, is that suddenly, since Chrome is non-native to anything, including Windows, Chrome is one of the slowest applications that I have on my laptop.
Can I tell you a story of when I was kind of converted to way of thinking of OS2? It was basically between the versions 2 and 3 before Warp came out. There were a couple of versions. As you look to the history of OS2, as I said, they brought a lot of additional, let's say, new developments and whatnot. One of the things that got me hooked up to OS2 in theory, because I was reading about it in the magazines, because it was way too expensive to buy. It was impossible. And in our country, you could not buy that either way. But what actually got me was the fact that you could do, as you said, multiple DOS boxes, DOS applications, all of that worked basically perfectly. By Warp, they were working perfectly, like excellently. But the thing that got me was when a DOS application crashed in OS2, the OS didn't crash, unlike Windows.
No, I have a.
Do you remember those days?
Yes, because the thing that you reminded me that the thing that got me interested in OS2 was another thing. When you tried to read something from floppy drive.
Oh yes.
That wasn't able to be read, so that had errors on it.
Mm-hmm.
The OS2 was the only operating system that was able to handle the interrupts in such a way that the operating system itself was working while the drive was being...
Shame on you, you are wrong. Amiga could do the same thing. And you are an Amiga guy.
Yes, Amiga could do the same thing, but I'm talking about modern operating systems. Sorry.
Yes.
Because we are not talking about the operating system that had a specific...
Windows were blue screening for that. Or reading CD.
Or they were blue screening for that. Or even worse, they would just stop doing anything and then just waiting for the...
getting red in the face.
Yes, waiting for a couple of minutes before the floppy became available again.
You're completely correct.
And this is one of those things. The second thing that got me interested was the way they dealt with... But this was with the OS2 Warp. The way they dealt with DVDs.
Yes.
And the CDs.
They had a built-in application for...
Yes, and the other thing was that they were able to digitally read the CDs, and then they were basically doing what we would call later ripping.
Yeah.
And then reproducing the digital audio out of it. So the digital audio wasn't... they didn't do the translation twice. And this was the thing that made much more sense to me when it came to quality of what would be read from the CD.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Yeah, I remember those days very well, because one of the earliest memories that I have of Microsoft Windows. My first Windows that I used at home specifically was 3.0, then 3.11, and I played with those Win32s extensions on them as well. But the first version of Windows that I actually tried, but not at home, was Windows 1. And then two, but for a very short period of time, because my dad had a couple of computers with those OSs in the office. It was only when Windows 3.1, 3.11 came out, and on the side, different side of the story, Windows NT, which I got into when I was in college. We already talked about that. That I started noticing that Microsoft is actually making a real investment into solving those. I wouldn't call these niggles. These were not small problems. I mean, being unable to read a floppy disk and getting blue screen is not normal. That's bonkers completely, especially nowadays. To that point, Windows 11, yes, 2 days ago when we were talking about my USB floppy, when I was trying to read from three floppies which were damaged, again, it just completely freezes for a while. It still does that, okay? But at the same time, when I was back way then, if you wanted to do it on OS2 or the old school Amigas, they were able to just work, yeah. And like a separate thread.
I think that this the reason why they're still doing it is backwards compatibility.
Yeah.
They want you to feel like you're dealing with floppies.
Yeah, sure. I love those backward compatibilities, which are unexciting, time-wasting, and completely irrationally wasting my time. That's what you like about all of that, of course. Being sarcastic as always. Okay, are there any other things that you remember those early, let's say, OS 2s for? Before Warp and the others, which we'll cover in a separate episode.
You first. Because I don't...
HBFS?
I don't specifically remember, because what I did way back then was... I wasn't used to, before I ran the Linux for the first time, I didn't think about operating system, disk, and file systems as separate things.
Yeah, you mentioned that in quite a few episodes, and I was the complete opposite of that.
Yes, because yeah, I was trying, back way then, I was trying to just be a simple user.
Okay.
I wanted my operating systems to make the best choice available to me for a given thing, mm-hmm. and I didn't care about the operating system using one thing or the other.
Okay.
Only later did I realize that the operating system itself was deeply flawed when it came to, by operating system I mean Windows, deeply flawed when it came to talking to disks, talking to outside devices, and that they had so many compatibility problems that they were trying to solve that what they did was, I wouldn't call it suboptimal. It was worse than that.
Yeah. I remember a couple of things that really caught my eyes in those early versions of OS 2, and I mentioned a couple of them, and I'm going to just keep on mentioning them because I think that they are very important. The first thing that really caught my eye in 1993, this was OS 2, 2.1, I think, if okay. I remember correctly from the history books. It had APM and PCMCIA support.
Yes.
Advanced power management.
Yes.
And PCMCIA cards. This was way before Windows had anything of the sorts. So again, point to OS 2. I read about those things in the magazine because I was able to use those features
without thinking
two, 3 years later in Windows, without necessarily thinking, if I had drivers for the devices for PCMCIA. So that's the first one. Then the second one, which is, let's say, more relevant for our work nowadays, professional work, not homework. There was a version of OS 2 in 1994, which had SMP support.
Yes, because it was designed to be an enterprise level operating system, so they needed remote. They needed a way to remotely control this operating system.
Up to 16 CPUs supported, which was only supported with the specific SMP hardware. But in 1993 and 1994, when you read about it, you were like,
phew. Yes, but this was way back then when when IBM was still thinking about that they are going to be more or less. Using the operating system for the next first. They were thinking about using that for the next 10, 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So they were trying to create a future-proof system. And the other thing was that they realized that the number of processors is going to necessarily scale up. And they didn't think that we are going to be stuck with the single processor PC for the better part of 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because once again, we need to think about how the market looked like.
Mm-hmm.
The market didn't become a multiprocessor market or multi-core market, to be more precise.
2003. 2002, 2003, 2004.
And the mainstream support for multiple cores came when Intel hit the 5 GHz barrier. And then when they realized that there is no way for them to create another processor that's going to be a single core. So they suddenly switched and tried to do the multi-core. But we had multiprocessor systems.
Yes.
That were mainly designed as a CPU and then a coprocessor.
Mm-hmm.
For usually for the arithmetics.
Mm-hmm.
And then this was integrated into the CPU itself.
Oh, SX.
SX version DX, DX and so on. And then after that, you didn't think about having multiple processors. IBM decided they're going to support them from the start because they were expecting that this is going to happen.
Yeah. So basically those features, and again, I'd only read about those features in a magazine because you couldn't buy those machines or OS in Croatia. It was not available completely. So we were stuck with our, either our 8-bit computers, you know, either our, you know, childhood memories of computers like Amstrad or Spectrum, or I played a lot of C64, whatnot. My next step was an XT, which was incredibly expensive all by itself, but still way less expensive than the same idea of XT or 286, let's be realistic, with OS2. It's just an incomprehensibly different price. It was twice plus, as you said, this
was an investment. Because I remember that the first, I'm just going to do a little bit of recalculating. Let me just try to do something.
You're going to recalculate how much Deutschmarks you spent for something.
Yes, I'm trying to recalculate how much money was my first PC that I actually got.
Mine was some crazy number, like 3,000 Deutschmarks with the printer.
Mine was something like 4,000 because it had
your 286.
No, 486. Came out,
I'm talking about my XT.
The first one, my 486 that I actually remember buying I remember the price for. Mm-hmm. Because the previous one I got it through a sale that was when the
voting machines or something.
No. This was for university games, and then it was a sale of the machines that were used for tabulating things. But Let me just quickly see if there is a possibility for me to.
While you do that, can I mention something else? For my perspective as just an end user. Now I'm not talking about our professional jobs or whatnot. Just as a regular user watching from the sidelines of what's happening in the end of the 80s up to mid 90s when all of that was mostly discontinued.
Okay.
One of the things that stood up to me very, like it's stuck with me for 30 years plus, you know, since the very beginning of OS2 up till today, is the fact that the OS2's presentation manager, the UI and whatnot, I would say that this was one of the key drivers of why UIs look like they do today. That's the first thing. And the second thing, it brought, as a result of Microsoft and IBM competing on the same market, it forced Microsoft to innovate with their UIs, because UIs back then started to become very important. We were very much used to DOS and, you know, CLI, and started games on our 8-bit computers from, you know, command line via BASIC or whatever, you know, load something.bash, whatever. But it is impossible to overstate how important it was that OS2 from the get-go started with the user interface, which was graphical, tried to push the development of that, which then influenced the rest of the market. And by that, I mostly, of course, mean.
But also, they took care that they're going to think about all the different DOS applications that need to run, because they realized that most of the people are not going to be able to run anything other than the DOS applications, because there weren't other graphical applications.
Yep.
Just to quickly go back to what I was doing, I was trying to recalculate, and the amazing thing is that more or less one Deutschmark from 1991 equals €1 from today.
Which it's supposed to be one to two, but
one
okay.
To two.
Yeah.
So basically 4,000 Deutschmarks from 1991 is €4,000 today. So this was the price of the actual PC.
Holy moly.
And this was something that you would pay today for a extremely high-end machine or some sort of workstation if you didn't want to buy a graphic card that is extremely high-end.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just for the amount that you paid for a normal machine back then.
Yeah.
This wasn't something extremely special. Okay, my machine had one thing that was special, and this was a big hard disk. But that was it.
My first XT had 20 megabyte hard disk.
I think that I had... I honestly
right at
know.
The time when I was reading about all of those things happening on the market, I had a 20 megabyte hard disk, and it was always full.
Yes,
although the games were very small.
Yes, and the other thing that I had, I think I had 40. But the thing is that when you put this into perspective, you could actually use your floppies to gain significant space because the your entire hard disk was 20 floppies.
Yeah.
Or even less.
Oh, no, I wasn't that lucky. I had those 5.25-inch drives, the first generation, which was 360.
Yes, but double-sided.
Yeah.
But you also could get to 180K for a single side.
When
PC.
I remember the way in which my desk looked with all of those boxes, plastic boxes of floppies inside.
Yes, they were
how they were expensive, like crazy.
Yes, you got the floppies. You also
in
could
paper,
buy.
In paper, you know.
Yes, but okay, but way back then, I remember that I was using a C64 that my friend had. And he was using double-sided floppy since the floppy for the C64 was single-sided. He had that device to get tabs on the floppy.
Mm-hmm.
So you could flip it over and use the other side for the to store the information on it.
Oh, man. Those were the days when we were physically changing stuff whenever we wanted to. You know, remember those plastic parts that you could take also, like with a screwdriver or
yes.
With pliers or whatnot, and then it became read-only and stuff like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes, yes. But the other thing was what was interesting and what is different than today. I think that the main thing that people don't understand right now is that those computers were concentration-inducing because you couldn't multitask.
Mm-hmm.
And today they are breaking our concentration down because everything is multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is competing for your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Back when then your computer had to do one thing and do it quickly. And since it didn't have enough power to do anything other than that, more or less you got a computer that was trying to make you concentrate on the task at hand.
Speaking of which, a couple of weeks ago when John Romero was here, we were trying to make Doom work in Windows 10. That was fun in DOSBox. And... the amount of stuff that we had to configure in audio drivers specifically in this case was it took hours for that to work. It did in the end, but output sound cards did not work for it, just as an example, which
okay, but this was
expected.
But this was expected because you either drove the hardware directly or you didn't do.
We should have do a test and start multiple copies of Doom and a couple of other DOS applications and then see if the OS is going to crash.
I remember that somebody did some testing of trying 100 copies of Doom at the same time
okay.
And seeing what the frame rate is going to be, and it was successful. So,
okay.
yes, you can do this.
Yeah. Okay, I don't want to try, but if you say so.
Okay.
Okay, I'm happy with this. This is where we can naturally stop because the episode is long enough and we have loads of other stuff that we need to discuss after the arrival of OS to Warp and some
okay.
of the subsequent versions. We'll save that for the next episode, but until then, Mr. Yasmin, my name is Vedran. See you in the next episode.
See you and bye.
Bye.